This morning, brothers and sisters, we'd like to talk on the subject of the Levitical priesthood. I think we concluded yesterday by mentioning in the 20th chapter of Exodus that the where the Ten Commandments are listed, that following the giving of those Ten Commandments, there was a building of an altar and an indication that worship was to be lifted up to the deity on behalf of the congregation of Israel. If we go back to the third chapter of Exodus, we sort of going to carry chronologically through this the book of Exodus maybe today, even though we might say at the outset that if you're an accurate and thorough study of the Mosaic law involving the Levitical order would consume more than the book of Exodus. Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy also would be, we would want to look at those too. Most of our material will be in Exodus. In the third chapter, and it is rather difficult for me to call out verses that will bring this thing home, but of necessity we'll try to do what we can. We should read maybe the whole chapter in some instances, but we'll just try to catch a verse or two. In the 18th verse of Exodus 3, we're here reading how that Moses and Aaron were appointed as God's spokesman. Of course, being of the tribe of Levi, they were sort of the initial spokesman and priests who were to sooner or later delegate the whole tribe, or sons of Aaron's and sons of Aaron in particular, and the Levites as a whole, as the priestly organization. Verse 18 says, "And they shall hearken to thy voice." That is speaking to, again, to Moses and Aaron. "And thou shalt come, thou and the elders of Israel." Now notice that term elders. It seems at this time we don't have an official priesthood, an official Levitical priesthood, I should say. And we have here the elders of Israel being called into the confidence of Moses and Aaron to help in this transition from Egypt to the land of Canaan. "And the elders of Israel unto the king of Egypt, and ye shall say unto him, The Lord God of the Hebrews hath met with us, and now let us go, we beseech thee, 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God." You know, in all of the instances where Moses appealed to Pharaoh for an occasion to let his people go, it was for the purpose of worshiping God or sacrificing or some measure to presumably retain the identity of Israel as God's special people. So we would never read such a thing as Moses and Aaron saying they just need rest from their work or we want to go for some incidental reason. It was to worship and that their nation might be trained in these things and that their thoughts and ambitions and all should have revolved around this. Looking at the next chapter 4 and verse 29 and to 31, we read these words. "And Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders again of the children of Israel." It seems that these elders were their direct assistants. "And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken unto Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel and that he had looked upon their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshiped." So as the account progresses toward their deliverance, we see them apparently in a reasonably favorable worship attitude. We all recognize that as soon as they had their deliverance through the sea and came into the wilderness, that they immediately began to complain, but it seems that the general attitude, as is recorded in these earlier chapters, indicate that Israel was of a turn of mind, that they were they still believed in their Creator and in His ability to direct their lives, and I would say, presumably in this case, to deliver them out of the hand of the oppressor. Jumping over to the 16th chapter, we realize there's a lot of material in between, but they arrive at Sinai. We're not covering any of the plagues or even the Passover or the incidents of the Exodus. But they arrive at Sinai in chapter 16, and there's some indication there that we want to mention. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. So if you're, not that you're looking for numbers or anything here, but it indicates that at this stage, now they're not at Sinai, but we've consumed 45 days. It says the second month and the 15th day. Looking over at the 19th chapter in the first verse, it says, in the third month. Now, I don't believe it specifies here. I was searching that a little bit. It just says, in the third month. It doesn't say the first day or the 15th day or any specific day. When the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai. I take that verse to indicate that from the passage through the sea to their arrival at their eventual encampment at the base of the Sinai Mountains and all was in the third month. So that could be either 60 or 75 or 90 maximum days. Moses it's not peculiar. It's characteristic of human nature. No sooner had they arrived here than they're engaged in a fight with an enemy or a warring nation, which involved the person of Amalek. That's in the 17th chapter. And again, we just make mention of it in passing. But after this fight with Amalek, Moses builds an altar in chapter 17, verses 15 and 16. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. For he said, because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Now, whether that's predictive of any of the Israeli-Arab conflicts that were to ensue over the years, I'm not able to say. He tells us the meaning of Jehovah Nissi, which is in the 16th verse. The margin of your Bibles may tell you, Jehovah is my banner, one of the many Jehovah names given to us, and several of them involving altars. Jethro, who was Moses' father-in-law, and we remember yesterday he is also called Reuel, sacrificed, continuing this identity of Israel with communion with God through a priest or through the medium of altars and sacrifices, in chapter 18, verse 12. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came, and all of the elders of Israel again, to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. Those of you who have a companion Bible are familiar with the various appendices attached to this Bible, and appendix number 15, if you want to make some kind of a note of that, gives a list of all of the laws that existed before the Mosaic Law. And it's quite a lengthy list, which should satisfy somebody who says, well, we really didn't have much of a law or much law that we could identify before the specifics and the elaborateness of the Mosaic Law, which takes volumes and volumes and pages and pages. But there are many, many laws. And here, somebody might ask in Exodus 18, 12, if Jethro was offering here burnt offerings and sacrifices, well, where did he get those instructions? Well, they must have been, I think we would conclude, God-given, God-ordered. And there were many laws between the time of Adam and Moses. And there were many even the behaviors we've commented on of the children of Israel in Egypt and coming out of Egypt indicated that they had an attentive ear to the instruction of the deity, and they were looking to him for direction in their lives. In the giving of the law by Moses at Sinai, there's one particular instruction that we want to point out, and that's in chapter 19, verses 22 and 24. Now, there were many others, but we're trying to emphasize the priestly aspect of this. Verse 22 says, "And let the priests also, which come near to the Lord, sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break through upon them." And verse 24, "And the Lord said unto him, Away, get thee down, and thou shalt come up, thou and Aaron with thee, but let not the priests and the people break through to come up unto the Lord, lest he break forth upon them." Now, to my knowledge, the priests haven't really been identified, but I think we could conclude that they are at least in a developmental stage at this point. And we will read at some chronologically future time in the book of Exodus and Numbers that, of course, as all of us know, the Levites as a tribe were established to serve in this priestly capacity. And again, as we pointed out the first day, and I incidentally came across two more verses last night that indicate, we'll read them later, that indicate that the priests of Levi were replacements or successors to the firstborn in the family. Now, following the giving of the Ten Commandments we mentioned yesterday in the 20th chapter of Exodus, we will mention again that an altar and a sacrifice are mentioned. I think with our general familiarity with the history maybe of the entire Old Testament, that it was very routine for men of God, following some incident, maybe a success in battle or whatever, that to go out and either build an altar, but particularly to sacrifice unto the Lord. Much as we might parallel that to our day. We may be engaged in a mental conflict. It doesn't have to be a conflict. It's just any a situation in which we, by virtue of our appreciation of the Lord and His work, would sacrifice in the sense of prayer or whatever we might, however we might act or perform our duty, similar to that was done in the Mosaic times. So anyway, we know that in this 20th chapter, these Ten Commandments were the basis for many other commandments, and they were near and dear to the nation of Israel. And it was the desire of the deity that these things be embedded in their affections and that their lives be guided by them. So it's very appropriate, I guess we could say, that they, upon receiving these, that an altar was built and sacrifices were made unto the Lord. I don't know how to. I'll just mention this as best I can. In chapters 21, 2, and 3, and that's a broad scope there, there are suggestions and the giving of many, many laws in those three chapters, but they imply, as I have reviewed them, the use of judges and perhaps priests to enforce these laws, and the feasts were commanded. Well, again, we might ask, if there are feasts commanded, how are they carried out? What's the routine? And I think most of us would probably agree that, well, if I were one of the sort of the common folk, as it were, a non-Levite, one of the other 11 tribes, I would use whatever God had left on record for me to use, which would be the priestly system, and go to that priest and do whatever I should have done. I'm not certain that in the observance of feasts that they all were centralized. That is, if I were of one of these other tribes, that I would have to go physically to another place to observe or celebrate that feast. But again, we're all generally familiar enough, I think, to know that the priest was a vital part of our worship function were we one of the children of Israel. Chapter 23 and verses 14 to 16 tells us, "Three times thou shalt keep a feast unto me in the year." And again, let your minds run along the lines, how was this done? Thou shalt keep the feast of unleavened bread. That was the first one. Thou shalt eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded thee in the time appointed in the month Abib. For in it thou camest out from Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. And secondly, and the feast of harvest, the first fruits of thy labors, which thou hast sown in the field. And thirdly, the feast of ingathering, which is in the end of the year, when thou hast gathered in thy labors of the field. So, without me being able to specify how all of these were done as involving the Levitical priesthood, I think, again, we would all generally agree that the camp of Israel as an entirety was to be a worshiping nation, and they were to utilize the system and the priest that God had ordained. The sanctuary was prescribed in Exodus 25, verses 8 and 9. And when we speak of the sanctuary, we actually are speaking of the central building, if we want to call it that, which was established in the wilderness at Sinai, and which was to set the stage for so many of the routine sacrifices and offerings and things that Israel was engaged in, and which was to be moved portably from place to place, from time to time, but was to remain, I think a correct statement would be, the dwelling place of God. God dwelled there in the sanctuary, figuratively, through the symbols that he had ordained, and Israel was to look upon this as their spiritual home, which would become, in the age to come, a symbol of their literal home. Exodus 25, 8 and 9. And let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show thee, after the pattern of the tabernacle, and the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so shall ye make it. Again, we know there's a great number of descriptions of the building of the tabernacle. I imagine that a great many people in this room have perhaps studied this and presented it in their Sunday school classes, and it's certainly not limited to a children's study by any means. There are so many facets in the structure of this tabernacle that are meaningful and point forward to things of our time and future times, that it's well worth a dedicated study any time we should choose to do so. Now, we sort of get to what we would hope would be a clinching argument here, that Aaron and his sons are the designated ministers to be the priests, and that is in the 28th chapter and the first verse. So after telling him how to build the sanctuary and all of the trappings and particularly the metals and cloth that went into this, the wood, the skins that were the covering, and I think I have, there's something over there. Some of you experts might tell us the back in 26:14, I think there's been an age-long argument on what the badger skins are there in that verse that were part of the covering for one of the inner portions of the tabernacle. You might present that to somebody this afternoon. Did I read the first verse? I don't think I did. And take thee unto thee Aaron thy brother and his sons with him from among the children of Israel, that he may minister unto me in the priest's office, and it names his sons as Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And we read about his sons. We probably most memorable would be Nadab and Abihu because of their failure to exercise the office of priest properly. We might at this time turn over to Numbers and the first chapter where they are, where the children of Israel by tribe are beginning to be numbered there. And I believe, I'm not certain of this, but I think they skipped the tribe of Levi in numbering. Am I right there? Does somebody know? Later on, they are counted, I believe, as 22,000 Levites. I don't know whether it's in this chapter or somewhere else. Where is it? third chapter. Yeah, I have that note down here, and I probably will read it, so give me a minute. But in Numbers 1, if we go over to the 47th verse and start in there, even the word but, it says but the Levites. Now, we've numbered Simeon and Judah and Issachar and some of the other tribes, but it says but the Levites, after the tribe of their fathers, were not numbered among them. I would assume, and I'm sort of not certain of some of these things, but when they numbered, we're told that when they came out of Egypt, there were 600,000. And scholars have suggested that didn't count the women and children, so giving every man a wife, which is an approximate, and every man one child or something, we'd have about 2 million people. Now, somebody could argue, well, they had three children, or they weren't all married, or this or that or the other, and come up with some other numbers. But I've generally heard the number 2 million of coming out of Egypt. But we are given here that there were 600,000 males. So the Levites, it says, were not numbered among them. For the Lord had spoken unto Moses, saying, only thou shalt not number the tribe of Levi, neither take the sum of them among the children of Israel. But thou shalt appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of testimony. That's going to be their job. And over all the vessels thereof, and over all things that belong to it. They shall bear the tabernacle, and all the vessels thereof. And they shall minister unto it, and shall encamp round about the tabernacle. And when the tabernacle setteth forward, that is, when they move it, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle is to be pitched, or relocated in another location, the Levites shall set it up, and the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death. And the children of Israel shall pitch their tents, every man by his own camp, and every man by his own standard, throughout their host. But the Levites shall pitch round about the tabernacle of testimony, that there be no wrath upon the congregation of the children of Israel, and the Levites shall keep the charge of the tabernacle of testimony. So there really are two sides to this thing. It was a privileged and special position for the Levites, but it was a work of labor as well. They did all the physical labor of breaking down the posts and things and loading them onto the wagons and moving them along as the occasion dictated. So it's not all, as we say, sitting around doing nothing. That they had a responsible position in which, if others had intruded, would have been stricken with death, but which they had a great responsibility to perform. And that might have a parallel in our own day, since we are a royal priesthood, not designated by tribe or any such thing as that, but that we have both responsibility to watch very carefully on how we do our work, and that we do some work. So it's not just sitting on our laurels and saying, well, the Lord has specially blessed us and we're in His people, or we're sort of privileged to have a position without some obligation and work being associated with it. Now, in Numbers 3, that may have been the reference that somebody gave us over here. Well, it is not. It's not the same thought. Numbers 3:12, and I beheld, I have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel instead of all the firstborn. This is the same statement we read the first day. I forget the reference. Might have been Numbers 8. But it's repeated two or three times. So I've taken the children instead of the firstborn that openeth the matrix among the children of Israel. Therefore, the Levites shall be mine. And I believe the same statement is made in chapter 4, verse 3. No, this gives their age specifications. From 30 years old and upward, even until 50 years old, all that enter into the host to do the work of the tabernacle of the congregation. So when the Levites began to serve, they did so at the age of 30. And for a period of 20 years out of their life, or until they were age 50, they functioned in the priestly office. Now, this may have been, as far as I can guess, in many instances, a very menial type of thing. Maybe if I were a priest working for those 20 years, all I did was rake the grounds or see that the wagons were well lubricated or something. And I think many times, myself included, we sort of think of the priest as a sort of a religious symbol who's going around and doing his offerings and placing the things on the altar and things like that. But these duties could have been alternated. I could have been a sort of an official priest in one period of time, and then later on I would be relegated to some other job to do. But they were dedicated to serve at age 30, and they ceased to serve at age 50. What would you think that this limited tenure would suggest? Why not let them serve on till 70, 80, 90, or why not start them at 15 or 20? What do you think was suggested in the limitation of age 30 to age 50? Anybody have an idea? Well, yeah, Brother Jim?
Well, probably make room for the other that's coming up.
All right, he suggested that the old-timer's got to go with Social Security, huh? Okay, anybody else? Here's one.
While they were in their strength, their prime slot, so they'd serve them all.
Anybody else? Dick?
Although it would appear that age 30 enough would be somewhat above prime, there still would be strength, yet there would be some experience and maturity.
The children of Israel, as they came through the land from 20 years old, were responsible, and the younger ones were not, and they were the ones that entered into the land. And I always thought that age was the age of their maturity.
I think at least all these answers are in the general ballpark, I think. That was sort of my thought, is that at 30, they were reasonably mature. We weren't using a novice, and I don't know if it has any parallel to Christ or other people who Christ was baptized at 30. And 50 would seem to, not that they were particularly worn out, but they had served their time. Maybe, as Brother Jim said, that maybe we had to move along and even give them other duties other than in the official tabernacle service. They didn't cease to be Levites by virtue of birth when they became 50, but they may have been placed outside the official organization. The camp, I don't know if I'm able to really describe it, and probably even if I was, if I could draw the picture on the board, the inner portion where we read that in one of these verses, where the camp around the tabernacle was peopled by the Levites, and it mentions the Merari and Gershom, and I forget the other one, that their camps or tents were associated out there, and Moses and Aaron were right in front, which was the eastern side, and then outside that Levitical portion, way on out, would be the other tribes, Dan, Naphtali, and the various ones. So the Levites were in this inner serving area, and as we've just pointed out, served for this 20-year period. There's also a very important point that we, not that we're saving it for tomorrow, but maybe we are, but we're going to reiterate it tomorrow, in relation to Melchizedek. Melchizedek being the order of our Lord and Savior, of his priesthood, was not qualified by what we would call fleshly arrangements. In other words, he didn't have to wait once he entered upon his priesthood to say, well, I'm not quite ready or I'm not qualified and that I'm going to cease to serve 20 years from now or when I become 50 years old as the Levites were, showing the superiority of the Melchizedek priesthood over the Levitical. The Levitical shows that in theory I only lasted 20 years. Again, not saying that you were completely ready for the grave, but your servitude was limited maybe to your best years. And after that, flesh being flesh, the Lord recognized that we need to replace it, and even what we're replacing it with is flesh too. So we want to remember very carefully and hopefully get from this consideration that the Melchizedek is the superior order of priesthood and the Levitical is a type leading up to that. The priestly garments, of which much could be said, are mentioned in the 28th chapter of Exodus. A very, very interesting subject. And when I say priest, I'm talking of the high priest. the fourth verse, 28:4. And these are the garments which they shall make, a breastplate, and an ephod, and a robe, and a broidered coat, and a mitre, and a girdle. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron thy brother and his sons, that he the colors and the embroidery and even the garments themselves. Perhaps we might mention the breastplate. But before we have the breastplate was a square hanging over the front of the priest, in which were 12 stones representing the 12 tribes of Israel. But that was on the outside. All these other things were under that. The ephod I've heard as described and maybe even translated as overall, which would be probably more completely covered him. An overall today, as we see it, has straps across the shoulder and covers us reasonably well, but not completely. But I believe this ephod was more of a coat that perhaps like we would be covered, not exactly like coveralls, but an overall covering. Of course, there was a robe which either went under that or and somehow was attached. The girdle, I believe, was a sash that like we would tie around our waist. And the mitre, of course, was his headgear. The breastplate may be more interesting to us than some of the others, and again, it may not, but I'll make a slight mention of that because it was probably the most decorative and the most obvious thing if you looked upon the priest and you saw this spread across his breast there. And on his shoulders, I think, were two onyx stones, each of which was engraved the names of six of the tribes of Israel. That's described over in the 9th to the 12th verse of this same chapter. In the breastplate, and somebody here might tell me, I don't know whether it was four rows of three stones or three rows of four stones. Who knows the answer? Or is there an answer? Anybody, any experts on that here? Who wants to make a guess? Well, a guess really is not much good in this case, I think. I don't even have an opinion. Is somebody there... Mr. Tucker? Maybe we haven't been reading, huh? All right, that tells us. I'm sorry. Yeah, it sure does. Four rows, three stones per row. Does that sound all right? Anyway, we know there are 12 stones, and I appreciate you clearing that up. I should have read that and had that at hand. And these stones were precious stones. Again, I think indicating that God had a precious interest in the signification of these stones, which was the sons of Jacob, or the nation of Israel. In verse 30, we are introduced in the... This is, again, part of the priest's attire and the signification of this attire, that it says, "And thou shalt put in the breastplate of judgment the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be upon Aaron's heart, when he goeth in before the Lord, and Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel upon his heart before the Lord continually." As I understand this breastplate, that in the lower part here were what we would call like a place where you put your hand in your coat in cold weather. What do they call that thing? Muffler or something like that. And that in this interior, it says it was folded. So in this interior piece was the Urim and Thummim. It reads in this 30th verse as if the Urim and Thummim were either stones or objects or something tangible that we could pick up. And some commentators, I believe, have said that when a matter of judgment came up, I suppose the priest reached in and got one of the stones, and so if it was black, it meant something, and if it was white, it meant something else. That was the judgment. Yes or no, I would assume. Brother Thomas covers this subject in Eureka, I would guess the first volume. And it's my understanding that he is of the opinion that Urim and Thummim were not tangible or literal stones or objects, but that somehow the Urim, which means lights, L-I-G-H-T-S, and Thummim, which means brilliance or fullness, that somehow the Lord answered by lights or by some manifestation of a glory that would instruct the priest that this was the judgment delivered in the matter. In other words, the priest was really saying, I'm unable to know what the Lord wants in all of these matters, so we implore or ask the Lord to give us an answer. And we are familiar in many cases with David and others of the kings that they inquired through the prophet, shall I go out to battle or shall I not? And of course, the prophet, by virtue of his communication with the Lord, says, don't go out or go out. And there was an answering device in this Urim and Thummim, whether we consider it literal objects or whether we consider it sort of a spiritual application. There's a mention of it over in, probably you can get from your margins, in Ezra and Nehemiah, where it says they didn't have any priests that could deliver. They didn't have Urim and Thummim. And therefore, until one stood up that was able to do this, that they were unable to get the Lord's decision or to function in whatever they were looking for. The altar in Exodus 29, verse 36, we notice was to be cleansed. And thou shalt offer every day a bullock for a sin offering for atonement. And thou shalt cleanse the altar when thou hast made an atonement for it. And thou shalt anoint it to sanctify it. 7 days shall thou make an atonement for the altar and sanctify it. And it shall be an altar most holy. Whatsoever toucheth the altar shall be holy. And it goes on to describe what should be offered. Now, what we might inquire, why should an inanimate object like an altar, which is made of material things, wood and stone, require cleansing? Because it's instructed here that they should cleanse it over a period of time. And verse 37 has just told us, 7 days shalt thou make an atonement for the altar. Doesn't this, for one thing, point to the fact that man, being of the condemned nature of Adam, of a structure of things material, dust and what have you, is in need of cleansing, and that we, if we're approaching the Lord again in this literal altar in the Levitical arrangement, we're doing it by the device that He has suggested, which is the altar, and that altar in itself is not a purely holy article. It is one that man has fashioned after God's instructions, and that through which He is going to offer His sacrifices unto the Lord. And, of course, it points forward to the figurative altar of Jesus Christ, who, again, was made of the stock and lineage of Adam and needed cleansing. And, of course, in the process of His offering for Himself and for the sins of the people, that cleansing was effected. So it's interesting for us to remember that the altar needed to be cleansed. There was also an altar of incense described in Exodus 30 over about the first 10 verses. So there were more physical features to this. We haven't really touched on many of them before you enter. These things are in the what we call the holy place as opposed to the most holy. And this altar of incense was a device that was ordered by the Lord through which the people would the priests, I should say, offer incense on a continuous basis unto the Lord. And we all are aware, I think, in the New Testament where it says, our prayers, let our prayers ascend as incense or a sweet-smelling savor. So this smoke or whatever it was that went up from the altar of incense was to show God that we were offering to Him of this incense, and that it represented the Israelitish thought and dedication of the day, and it was to be done continually. The measurements are given for these altars in terms of cubits. I'm not sure it's the same cubit as in Leviticus, in Ezekiel. But at that point, I believe traditionally a biblical cubit has been the distance from the tip of your finger to the elbow. And as we know, yours might be longer or shorter than mine. So I might say 16 inches and you might say 18 or 16 and a half or certain things. But students or scholars or some have refined this down to where I think we generally think of a cubit as 18 inches. And I know in Ezekiel it says each cubit was a cubit and a hand breadth, which is 4 more inches. So the width of our hand, and again, we all have different size hands, but in biblical terms, a cubit and a hand breadth would be roughly 22 inches. Or in some cases, we're given a span, which would be from tip of finger to tip of thumb, which would be about 8 inches. So some of you will have Bibles that maybe in the back give you all these measurements and weights and things like that. But these altars were very utilitarian. We didn't have an altar head high so that you'd get up here to offer a sacrifice. It was roughly 28, 29, 30 inches tall, much like our table or kitchen cabinets in our homes. So these, again, there's a utilitarian aspect to them so that we're not talking of something out of reason or out of reach. So the altar of incense is described there. I'm not sure. We could read it and get the cubits and so forth. In Exodus 36, we have a description of the work of the tabernacle. Maybe we can say in quickly passing by that the two men in charge of gathering this material and fashioning it into the glorious work that it resulted in were Bezaleel, 36 verse 1, and Aholiab. Bezaleel came from the tribe of Judah, and Aholiab came from the tribe of Dan, and he was the engraver, whereas I think Bezaleel was more the craftsman that would put this thing together. Seems Bezaleel's name is mentioned more often. I don't know if that means he was the chief and Aholiab was the assistant. But those two men were charged with the work of gathering the material from all of the willing subjects in the camp of Israel. So that means if we in the camp of Israel are to put our hand, let's say, to the building of the temple of God, which is the human aspect of this thing, we are the temple of God by virtue of our attitude and relationship to Him. So we were to pitch in, and they gave how much of their gold and material? Did it say here, if those of you that are familiar with this, did they give half enough or what? More than enough. They gave more, and they had to cut them off. They says that's too much and enough. So I think there's a story there that those who gave liberally and were well dedicated to what this thing was to represent. That it was God's building. He was to dwell there. They were to be related to Him. They could express their appreciation and dedication through offerings, through the priests, and the various artifices that were associated with it. Now, they also made the ark in Exodus 37, first couple of verses, which was the chest. And again, it's very utilitarian, its size and all. Not quite as large as this table here in the front, but it was portable. It had the rings in it and the staves because you weren't to touch this thing. It was holy. And the priests or the Levites, when they moved it from place to place, they placed the shittim wood poles in the rings and picked it up. And some of the other articles were the same. There was the mercy seat and the cherubim that were on top of this ark, or it was later called the Ark of the Covenant. And within that chest were placed memorable items which were to call Israel's attention to the work of deity and to their association and dedication to Him. The altar is mentioned again in Exodus 38, the first two or three verses. And I don't think we read, there your length and width and all is given, but back in the 20th chapter, there is a comment that might be made. I think it's the last verse of the 20th chapter where he's talking of the altar. Now, I'm not certain. Well, this is in the same chapter with the giving of the Ten Commandments. It mentions there an altar of earth in the 24th verse. 25th says, "If thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone." That is, man's not to lay his tools upon it and say, in effect, "That's my work." These were to be native stones that God had arranged. And "for if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it." And I'm interested particularly in verse 26. "Neither shalt thou go up by steps unto mine altar, that thy nakedness be not discovered thereon." Again, God is saying to the people and to us that the way to worship me is a way of strict and true holiness. We're not talking about man deciding that he wants to do something, he'll do it his way. But God even specified, as I read that verse, that this altar, which may have been elevated, that you weren't to go up by steps. And most of us very readily would say, well, what's wrong with steps? And apparently with this, even with this priest with his long robes, which I assume would be much of a, you know, not like pants or something we wear today, in lifting his feet up would show some of the flesh that might have been at his ankle area or something like that. And God did not want this in any way associated with the act and art of worship that they were to effect. So I believe that 26th verse of Exodus 20 may suggest that man should be completely covered, or the priest in this case, who's representative of all the men, and that God was to be approached as a strictly very holy thing, and with no insertion of the flesh or the flesh's ideas. We're just about a minute away from our time expiring. I just want to say maybe one more word, that going from Exodus on through the Old Testament, we do have a recognition of the Mosaic and the Levitical and the priestly system. We have various high priests that succeeded Aaron and his sons over the years, prominently mentioned and one which parallels the Melchizedek priesthood of Christ, is that of Zadok, who was the high priest in the time of David, who later anointed Solomon king, and who was high priest along in Solomon's time. His son Ahimeaz was also described as one of the high priests, and Abiathar, and I believe Ahimelech or some name, I'm not too sure. And the way it's recorded, I have the notes down here, 2 Samuel 8:17 and 2 Samuel 20 and 25, mention that Zadok and Abiathar were the priests. It doesn't say high priest. And I'm at a loss to say, how come we had two high priests, if we did? I don't much think we did, but maybe one was an associate that was to move into this office later or not. But you might, that's something I can only throw out as a question. But you yourself might think of more names down through the years that served as high priests and endeavored to function in the Levitical system, to draw the people to God, to get them to worship, and to point forward to the greater high priest that was to come and who was to effect their salvation.